With our special guest tonight, Stephen Shohat, his book, Hollywood Stories. We're going to come back in a moment, talk more about some of these horror classics, and also take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Stephen Shohat, and we're going to take your call. Stephen, would one consider Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs to be a horror type, a cartoon film?
Well, probably not today, but the British did back in the 30s. They wouldn't let it be shown there. They were banning all horror films. And the thing that really frightened people at the time was the Queen's transformation into the peddler woman. And what happened was there was an actress playing that role who was a great stage actress whose name was Lucille Laverne. And Walt and the staff, they were happy when she did the Queen, but when she had to change to the peddler woman, they were unsatisfied. And they said, oh, Lucille, you know, she's not beautiful anymore now. She's a hag. She's like a snake. We're not getting that for your performance. And she said, I think I know what you want. Will you excuse me? And she left the recording room, came back about 5 minutes later and said, okay, let's do it now. So they re-recorded it, and this time she's on the money, and everybody there is getting thrills and chills, and she finishes, and they clap their hands, and Walt said, oh, Lucille, that was great, but what did you do when you left the room? And she smiled at him and said, I took my teeth out.
Unbelievable.
And I'll tell you what, they had problems at Radio City Music Hall where the movie was breaking records because in 1938, because some of the kids would get so scared by that the evil peddler woman that the seats kept getting wet and they had to keep replacing them.
Really?
Yeah.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. At the time, it was a frightening movie. I think... That's what happened with Disney's movies. Like Fantasia, for example, did not have the success of Snow White. That was a money loser when it came out. And a lot of parents felt that the final scene where the devil damns the souls, and the devil, by the way, the model for the devil was Bela Lugosi. But the Night on Bald Mountain sequence, it was felt that was unfit for children. And so a lot of parents complained to movie theater managers at the time. There were a lot of things that happened with Walt Disney that weren't considered to be family things. He sort of grew into that role as a purveyor of family entertainment as time went on.
1958, The Blob with Steve McQueen.
Well, he had the exact same thing that you were talking about with Vincent Price, with Steve McQueen. They offered him $3,000 plus like 10% of the gross or a straight $10,000. And he needed the money, and he took the $10,000. And he just, it would frustrate him to no end that movie just made a ton of profits, played on The Late Show all the time. So sometimes he would, you know, people would come up to him and say, hey, I saw you in The Blob. I wasn't in that. You know, he would just deny it. And then other times he'd be proud because it was the first time that his sort of king of cool persona came off on the screen. But most of the time he would just laugh because he's thinking, you know, I mean, here I am playing a bug-eyed teen being terrorized by a mound of Jell-O. But he was, like so many actors, upset that he chose not to take the share of the profits and the money up front.
Let's go to some of the calls. Aberdeen, New Jersey. First-time caller, Jerry's with us. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, George. And I don't know the name
Stephen. Stephen is our guest.
How you doing?
Stephen. Glad to speak to you guys. Long-time listener, first-time caller. When you guys were talking about the creature from the Black Lagoon, you didn't know who played the creature. One of them was named Ben Chapman. And Ben did all the underwater sequences.
Okay.
They had several actors do it. But yeah. I met Ben Chapman at a memorabilia show. He passed on a couple years ago.
But
he was a very, very nice guy. He was from Hawaii.
They weren't credited, were they, the guys who did that at the time?
No.
Yeah.
In fact, he showed me his contract, and he was paid like $1,500 for
and it was a lot of money then.
Oh, yeah. He said that to me. He said it was, you know, it was great money for the time, you know. I even took a copy of his contract and the pictures with him. He was a great guy. He was from Hawaii. Another interesting thing, he was John Hall's cousin. John Hall was in the movie Hurricane with Dorothy L'Amour, if you remember.
That's going way back.
Oh, yeah, 1938.
Way back. Okay, thanks for those tidbits, Jerry. Psycho still remains one of the scary movies. We talked a little bit about Norman Bates. How did Hitchcock ever conceive of that shower scene, Stephen?
Well, the shower scene is described in the Robert Bloch book. Now, the thing is that actually, as violent as Psycho is considered to be, the Robert Bloch book was way, way more graphic of what Norman Bates did to Marion. I think her name was Mary in the book. But anyway, you know, Hitchcock was always thinking of what could be done cinematically. And of course, there were a lot of things about that movie, the filming of it in black and white so he could use chocolate syrup rather than blood, putting up his own money for it so he used his television crew because Paramount Studios was so reluctant to do it because he wanted to do something different at the time, and it really was different. See, the one thing, Hitchcock always used to make a distinction between horror and suspense, and he always used to say, horror doesn't take much thought. You know, if something jumps out at you, that's horrifying. It lasts for like 2 seconds. But suspense is when the audience knows something that the characters don't know. Like, say you have two guys talking at a table, and say you put a bomb underneath the table, and the audience knows that, and the two guys don't. The audience is dying for them to look under the table. And you just stretch it out. Now, the thing was that he had made a movie 2 years before Psycho, which was really suspenseful, Vertigo, where the audience knew something that the James Stewart character did not know. I won't give it away if people haven't
right,
seen it.
Right.
But that movie was a failure at the box office, although, you know, now...
It did well later on, of course.
Yeah, now it's considered, you know, it got its just do. But Hitchcock had, you know, he was always aware of what was going on. He was always aware of the news and the industry. And he saw that like these Edgar Allan Poe movies, these low-budget movies that Vincent Price was in and that William Castle was making, some of these movies were doing great. And so he thought he would get into the low-budget horror realm, but do it as cinematically as possible. And he came up with the gimmick where he actually killed a movie star early on into the movie for the absolute shock value. And you know, the Psycho was such an enormous hit. I mean, it was, you know, it just did terrifically with audiences, but it was a bit of an embarrassment for Hitchcock because he'd go to parties and people would say to him, Hitch, how could you make that disgusting movie? And he'd say, oh, it's a comedy. Don't take it so seriously. but there were other times where he would lament that you know, that why didn't they like Vertigo, which is my gourmet meal, and instead they eat the hamburger and french fries, which is Psycho. Just to jump ahead with that, you know, Hitchcock sold the rights of Psycho back to Universal Studios, and he became the number three stockholder at Universal Studios. And so he made his final movie in 1975, Family Plot. And he's 75 years old. He gets to the set early, pick up the Wall Street Journal. Every day he's happy because there's this new movie, Jaws, and it's breaking records, and the Universal MCA stock is going through the roof. And then there was one day he was there early, and he felt uncomfortable, and it's like he had eyes in the back of his head, and he called over one of the security guards and said, there's a young man hovering over there in the background, have him removed at once. And it turned out that the young man was Steven Spielberg, the source of Hitchcock's happiness, who just simply wanted to meet his idol.
Did they ever meet?
They did. But you know, he kept showing up, and one of the stars of the movie, Bruce Dern, Hitchcock would always say, Bruce, what does that young man want? Well, he wants to meet you, Hitch. Well, Bruce, he made that Fish movie. I don't know what to say to him, but eventually, you know, they did meet, and Hitchcock was gracious. Of course, Spielberg, he always paid Hitchcock such a high compliment because the shark never worked in Jaws, and therefore Spielberg had to imply the shark was there with the music and
that's
the barrel,
right, which is called, Hitchcockian, isn't it?
That's right. That's the word he used, Hitchcockian.
That's exactly what it is. Let's go to Charleston, West Virginia. It's James' turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, James, go ahead.
Good morning. How are you, gentlemen?
Good,
doing?
James. Good.
How are you doing? I'm doing fine. I wanted to let you know that other people that played in some of those, Lugosi did play the Frankenstein's monster.
Yes, and, he did. Ghost of Frankenstein.
Right, and he had lines in it. If you ever take a chance of watching it, you'll see his mouth move. They edited the lines out, but he's actually talking. And he's supposed to portray the creature as being blind because of the preceding movie, he had lost his eyesight.
Yeah, and he collapsed on the set. He was suffering from the oxygen. There were nine of those movies. Boris retired after the third one, Son of Frankenstein. Well, not retired, but chose not to play the role anymore.
Right.
And then Bela finally got to play him, and Lon Chaney played him, and Glenn Strange played him. So
and Chaney Jr. played the Mummy, and the cowboy actor Tom Tyler played him in one motion picture. Played the Mummy in one motion picture.
Yeah.
And Rico Browning was the other person who did the dive scenes for the creature from and the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
And you were talking about meeting actors. I had the honor, and her name escapes me now. The woman that played Sylvia Van Buren in War of the Worlds. I had the honor of meeting her at one time during a anniversary of the movie.
Was this the original?
Yes.
Way gone back, yeah.
Yes, when Gene Barry, Les Tremaine was all in it, the George Powell version. I got to meet her during my first tour of duty in the military. I was at a convention in New York, and she was working behind at a desk, and I walked away, and I saw it. I saw she had been in Tom Corbett's Space Cadet on television.
That was Anne Robinson.
Yes, and I started to walk away, and I turned around and went, Sylvia Van Buren, and she said, thank you. But she was a very, very nice lady. I met Forrest J. Ackerman just by accident. I bumped into him in a hallway at a convention I was at in California at one time. He was just passing through. He was an interesting fellow.
Great
you know, I've had good luck not every single time, but 95% of the time I've met actors, they've just been gracious and willing to talk and are flattered, you know? So as long as you're not intrusive.
It's just high by, you know, if they're going by, you know, I think they're very polite, but you know, if they're sitting at a table with their girlfriend, their wife or friends, you can't sit down with them.
Yeah, no.
And I've seen that happen, Steve.
Yeah. It's part of their job too. I think I read one time that, you know, it's 5% acting and 95% promoting.
You know what? That's exactly right.
Yeah. So being gracious is just, it can't hurt. I mean, you know, there's another story about Michael Caine at Universal Studios. He was making this movie one time, and I think it was Harry Sundowner, but it might be another movie. And the tour guide kept finding him and leading people to meet and greet him. And he was thinking about getting the tour guide fired. And finally he said, you know, it's just easy to be gracious. Why not go along with it? And it was a very good thing because the tour guide turned out to be Michael Ovitz, who later started Creative Artist Agency.
That's right.
Yeah, one of the biggest agencies in Hollywood. So you know, it was an object lesson about just being gracious to everybody.
Small world, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is. Why the craze of those films in that era? What was going on during society in order for people to be so excited about those kind of horror films? I mean, we had, remember the black and white one, Them, about those radioactive ants, those huge ants?
Well, sure. In the 50s, I mean, every era is different. In the 50s, it's, you know, atomic radiation.
Yeah.
And more science fiction films.
Which was huge in the Japanese films at the time.
Right, right. Right. But I don't know. I mean, a lot of films play at drive-in movie theaters and things like that. And you know, who knows if people are watching them even, you know, when they're going to see them. It's just, I mean, it's just something that appealed at the time. It's always interesting to say why something, why one genre is popular. The thing about horror movies is they can be so cheap to make. I mean, for entry level filmmakers, if they come up with certain ideas, like Wes Craven, he wasn't exactly entry level, but he used to see this hobo walking home from school, and he combined him with this bully in school named Freddy, and so that's how he got the idea for Freddy Krueger, what's his name? Toby, I can't remember his name right now, but he's the one who directed Poltergeist for Spielberg. I think it's Toby Hooper. He was in line at a hardware store, and he had this fantasy about getting a chainsaw off the wall and cutting through everybody, and that's what inspired the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So
yeah, Toby Hooper, that's who it was.
Toby Hooper, yeah. So I mean, then you have, even more modern movies made for like $20,000, Paranormal Activity or The Blair Witch Project, or a movie like The Sixth Sense, which really didn't start off being, it really wasn't a high budget movie, and they decided to take a shot at asking Bruce Willis to do it, and he loved the script so much that he agreed to do it for a much lower fee, and not get his usual $20 million salary. So, I mean, with horror movies, from a filmmaking standpoint, they give you an opportunity to really have a chance of breaking into the business. And I think if you have those sort of Hitchcock elements where what you don't see is scarier than what you do see, I think it's a universal thing. I don't think it belongs to any age particularly. I think something like that always has a chance to catch on.
I remember the days of those drive-ins, going with my parents, wearing my pajamas with the feet, going to get a hot dog, walking through the gravelly parking lot, and then falling asleep in the back seat. It was great.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
A, well, what I a think, time.
Yeah, I think people often did other things besides watch the movies at the drive-in.
That's true. Of course, not when you're with your family.
Right.
Stephen, tell us about the book Hollywood Stories. Where do you get it?
Sure. The book Hollywood Stories, short, entertaining anecdotes about the stars and legends of the movies, available wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. The website is hollywoodstories.com with all the links. One word, hollywoodstories.com. And that has information about the tourism, too.
You enjoy doing what you do, don't you?
I really enjoy telling stories, really enjoy meeting people. I enjoy writing quite a bit, and it's nice to get good feedback on the book.
Stephen, we're going to come back and have final phone calls with you in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Those of you who are on hold, just hang there, and I shall be right back with you with our special guest, Stephen Choate, as we talk about his work, Hollywood Stories. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Well, those Friday night into Saturday morning open lines start next hour. Hey, by the way, Ghost to Ghost coming up on Halloween night. Would you like to participate? Send us your ghost story to ghoststories@coasttocoastam.com. You can find all that information and the link at our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. Let's come back and take final phone calls with Stephen Choate as we talk about his stories on Hollywood Stories, his book, and all these spooky things next on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, we're dear friends with Kane Hodder, of course, who was Jason Voorhees in the Friday the 13th movies. And, you know, it's funny, you're right. You kind of expect them in real life to act that way. And they don't when you meet them. They're nice. They're fun. They're funny. But they're definitely not funny.
I don't know if I expect him to act that way, you know, but I'll tell you what, Vincent Price, though, he used to go to the Hollywood Wax Museum. I don't know how often he did this, maybe once or twice, but he disguised himself as a wax dummy of himself.
And just stand there, huh?
Yeah, stand there, wait till somebody unsuspecting would walk by, and then reach out and squirt them with a hypodermic syringe full of water.
That's him. That's Vincent Price.
Yeah. So I don't usually expect people to act that way, but you know, I guess some do.
Who is yeah, your I mean, I, Who's your all-time favorite horror star?
Oh, well, does Ernest Borgnine count, since he was in Willard and actually had to be covered with rats and got bit and got a tetanus shot? I don't know.
He was McHale in the Navy show, wasn't he?
Right. That's his main thing. And, I don't know if you consider Poseidon Adventure a movie, but I think he's my all-time favorite actor, really. Do I have a minute to tell a story about him?
You sure do.
Okay. When he was in the movie Marty, his Academy Award winning movie, he was walking back to the set and these four are walking back to his dressing room from the set. These four guys came up to him and said, "Hey, are you the guy who beat up Sinatra and From Here to Eternity?" And he goes, "Yeah, that was me." He goes, "Well, now we're going to beat you up." And
whoa.
And he said, "All right, listen, I'll fight you one at a time. But, I'm not going to take all four of you on at once, but you're making a mistake. Sinatra and I are buddies. We're Passan. That's only a movie." And they said, "Passan, are you Italian?" He says, "Yes, the family name is Borgonino. My mother changed it when we came over to America." He goes, "Well, why didn't you say so?" And they ended up taking him out to lunch instead, and they treated him to meals for the rest of the shoot.
I love it. To the phones we go, west of the Rockies, Calistoga, California. Michael's turn. Michael, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, George.
Hi, Michael.
I grew up in a little town of Brookfield, Illinois.
I know it well.
You do?
Yeah, sure do. I used to go to Illinois a lot.
Ah, yeah. Well, at that time, there was this little theater in town, the Strand Theater. And one summer, every Wednesday night, they'd play two of these classic Universal films. So I've probably seen every one of them. It was amazing.
What's your favorite?
Huh?
What was your favorite?
Oh, God. I think they
were all great.
Yeah, they were. Just about anything with Boris Karloff.
How much did it cost you, Michael, to get to the theater in those days?
Well, at that time, I can't remember exactly, but I remember at one time, kids could get in for 9 cents. This was in the 40s.
9 cents.
I mean, When you think about a movie like Snow White, when it came out in 1937 and ran through 1938, it made $8 million, and movie tickets cost 25 cents for adults and a dime for kids. So if you do the math, it's like half the people in the country saw it.
And you know what? Today, it probably would have been one of the highest grossing movies if you could multiply that.
Right. Yeah, it's way up there. So, when you consider inflation and everything like that. So, most movies weren't big hits like that, but the ones that did made an incredible amount of money. That's why World War I was one of the big things that really helped Los Angeles economically, because the European film industry really slowed down because of that, and that's when American movies became popular around the world. And then you had people like Chaplin and Pickford and Fairbanks started making enormous amounts of money, like $1 million a year, at a time when the average house in L.A. cost $2,000. And then that's when L.A. really started to become more of a boomtown with the movie industry growth.
Do you find when you're doing your tour guiding that people are interested still in Marilyn Monroe, Stephen?
Marilyn Monroe's always a big interest. She's probably the most popular handprint and footprint square at the Chinese Theater. And I can tell a quick story about that. When she got her handprints and footprints, it was in 1953, and she was promoting the movie Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And she was absolutely thrilled, because that theater has been around since 1927, and she used to go there and watch movies as a little girl, and she'd always compare her hands and her feet to that of her idols, Jean Harlow's. So it was just thrilling for her to be out there and have this actually happening to her. It's still pretty rarefied air, only about 250 handprint and footprint recipients. So she's standing out there with Jane Russell, and there's a big crowd, and she's blowing kisses. And she says to Jane Russell, "Oh, hey, look, Janie, not everybody puts their hands and feet in the wet cement. You got Jimmy Durante's nose, Monty Woolley's beard. I think we should put in the body parts we're going to be most remembered for." And she actually held up the ceremony and asked the 20th Century Fox officials if she could sit in the wet cement and Jane Russell could stick her chest into it. But they said no, unfortunately, for the photographers there, so they had to settle for their hands and feet.
I love it. Okay, we go to Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Howard, go ahead. First-time caller.
Yes, this is George.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, you guys were talking about the classic monster movies.
Yeah.
Things like the Blob, them.
Yep.
What about the movie like the original The Thing?
Yeah, the Howard Hawks movie.
That was a classic, Stephen.
Yeah, it was. It was. Howard Hawks was a great character too. I offhand, I can't tell you a really good story about that movie, but I can tell you that Howard Hawks was the one who directed the movie I just mentioned, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and he didn't necessarily want to work with Marilyn Monroe because she was late to the set all the time. And he was in Daryl Zanuck's office, the head of 20th Century Fox, and he said, I'll direct the movie under one condition. You get me Jane Russell. And he says, Howard, we tried to get Jane Russell, but she's unavailable. He said, no, she's not. Give me the phone. So he called Jane Russell up on Daryl Zanuck's phone, and it turned out that Howard Hawks had discovered, along with Howard Hughes, Jane Russell back in 1939, 14 years before, when she was 18, and working in a dentist office for $10 a week. So she'll do anything for Howard Hawks. So he gets her on the phone and says, honey, I want you for the new Monroe picture. Says, okay, Howard, when do we start? Said, oh, you're great, honey. How much do you want? Says, Howard, do you think you can get me $50,000? So he's still on the phone. He eyes Daryl Zanuck. No, I don't think so, honey. Try again. $75,000? Oh, you're playing hardball. Give me another number. So the conversation went on for about 3 minutes, and finally Howard Hawks cupped the receiver, and he said to Daryl Zanuck, great news. I got her down to $200,000.
I love it.
And Daryl Zanuck agreed, and it turned out to be a very good choice. And, you know, I will try and get some good stories about The Thing. I don't have any at the top of my head, but, I'll try and I'm writing a second book.
So Stephen, what did you think of the old black and white compared to color films?
I don't really care that much. You know, that's something that never makes a difference to me. I mean, if it's a great movie like It's a Wonderful Life or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and Moves Along, I don't really have a preference, you know, Casablanca, whatever it is. But I like modern movies too. So I go more for pace than looking whether it's color or black and white. And sometimes, you know, with color movies, I like fantastic scenery and set design. I really enjoyed the movie, the remake of True Grit that the Coen brothers did a couple of years ago. I thought that was just about the best production design I've ever seen in a movie.
Oh, John Wayne was in the original, right?
Yes, he was. He was. And they got great stories about him.
We're going to Wichita, Kansas now. Chuck, you're on with us. Go ahead, Chuck.
Good evening. I had a couple of questions for Stephen. I've always heard that Alfred Hitchcock would appear in all of his movies and shows in a bit part during some interval during the show. Just show
cameo.
Up.
You know. Oh, yeah, that's true. You know, he did that initially he had a scene in one of the early movies, and he was just trying to fill it up with more people, so he stood in. And then the movie, it was either The Pleasure Garden or The Lodger. It was a big success. He started doing it because of Superstition. And I'll tell you, his toughest job with that was Lifeboat, because you know, you got seven people on a lifeboat, so how do you get Hitchcock into the middle of the ocean?
Right.
So he had a magazine roll by, and Hitchcock had just lost some weight. And so it had a before and after shot with this phony product called Reduso.
And he was in it.
he just made it up, Reduso, but then he got tons of letters saying, where can we buy this product? It didn't exist.
Yeah, one other thing. There was a movie, and I can't remember the name or anything of it, but it was like a black Lady Dracula, real sexy and more black.
Elvira, right?
Elvira, right. And I heard that the actress was from Kansas.
Oh, Cassandra Peterson?
Uh-huh.
I don't know off the top of my head, but, you know.
One other thing, you mentioned Marilyn Monroe. I fought with the 1st Marine Division in Korea during the war over there, and Marilyn came over, one of the few that did, Terry Moore and Marilyn Monroe, and is in a rear area, and I wasn't able to go, but they had to build her a special heated stage. She wore the short costumes.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I never met Marilyn Monroe. Obviously, she passed, before I was born. But I'll tell you, I did meet Zsa Zsa Gabor. By the way, Cassandra Peterson was born in Manhattan, Kansas. But Zsa Zsa Gabor, she was so nice to everybody. We met her on the tour. And she always went with Bob Hope whenever he would entertain the troops. And I'll tell you, Bob Hope would have a tough time sometimes because people were saying, oh, are we going to get a nice dressing room? And he'd say, oh, we're going to a combat zone in Korea. What are you talking about? But Zsa Zsa Gabor, she'd go with him every time. She'd do anything for the troops. And they have the running gag where they go out on stage and Bob Hope would say, Zsa Zsa, is it true you don't have any domestic skills at all? And she'd say, no, Robert, darling, what are you talking about? I'm a great housekeeper. Every time I get the divorce, I keep the house.
I love that, too. Let's go to take a few more calls, and then that's it. Stephen, thanks, by the way, for being on the show. You're doing a great job here. We're going out to Hawaii. Vonnie's with us, way west. Hey, Vonnie, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Way West. Oh, I love this show. Aloha, George. Aloha, Stephen.
Aloha. I wish I was there.
I loved your story about Ernest Borgnine. What a wonderful, wonderful, incredible man he was.
He was. He's my all-time favorite.
Ernest Borgnine on the set of The Single Guy. And I was just a bit player in the show. But I saw Ernest sitting in a chair, and I walked up to him, and I said, Mr. Borgnine, I have to tell you what a huge fan I am of you, and I loved the movie Marty. It's one of my all-time favorite movies. And I said, I know you probably get really tired of hearing this your whole life. And he said, oh, no, young lady, I never, never get tired of hearing that.
Yeah.
I love when he was so gracious, so wonderful, and he was just so incredible. And he said, I love hearing it every single time. It doesn't matter how many times people tell me that. I love it, and I appreciate that so much.
He's so gracious.
I loved him.
I think he's my favorite actor, and I have the DVD, the audio commentary for The Poseidon Adventure by the director Ronald Neim. And he was saying that when he made the movie, that every actor would have a bit of temperament, and it wouldn't last, but that meant if you had 10 actors, you get it every single day if you're him. But he said the two actors that didn't have the temperament were Eric Shea, the little boy who never acted in another movie again, he said, and Ernest Borgnine. Ernest Borgnine was the only one who never complained. And it's so ironic because his character in that movie is constantly complaining about their predicament. But he said he was just an absolute joy to work with. And everybody said that. Peckinpah said that on The Wild Bunch. I mean, everybody said that Ernest Borgnine was just the greatest guy. So, obviously he'll be missed by a lot of people.
So tell me a little bit about Planet of the Apes, people dressing up as monkeys, scaring people. What was going on with that?
Oh, yeah. Well, they had the interesting thing when they made that movie back in 1968. Charlton Heston noticed right away that the chimps hung with the chimps, the orangutans hung with the orangutans, and the gorillas did the same during lunch. And in fact, Kim Hunter and Maurice Evans were good friends before the movie, but once she became a chimp and he became an orangutan, they couldn't speak to each other when they didn't have scenes together. Roddy McDowell, he hated taking off his makeup at the end of the day. So sometimes he'd drive down the freeway in the ape outfit, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, stuck in traffic. And although people probably just thought it was another guy in L.A., the way things are around here.
You never know.
Yeah, but Roddy McDowell, when he was making the movie, he found out that Julie Andrews was making the movie Star about Gertrude Lawrence at the same time on the 20th Century Fox a lot, and he knew Julie Andrews because they were in the play Camelot together, and you know, she was going through a tough time. She had won the Academy Award for Mary Poppins, and then the big hit with The Sound of Music, but then she had divorced her husband Tony Walton, and she was in therapy. And one time she was on the phone in her dressing room talking about whatever problems that she was having, and all of a sudden she's like, "Oh, there's a giant ape in here with me," and so anyway, he chased her around for a little bit, I guess, but then revealed who he was.
We've got Bruce now in Asheville, North Carolina. Bruce, you're on with Stephen. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi guys. How you doing?
Good.
How you doing?
We had a family business in New Jersey, and we hired a secretary, and I asked her what she did before this, and she said, "I was an actress." And I said, "Really?" I said, "What did you play in?" She said, "Well, when I went to the University of Pennsylvania, I was one of the flesh eaters in Night of the Living Dead." And they said that she told me that they didn't pay anybody. It was just show up and wear your raggediest stuff.
What a deal. Yeah, I thought they'd get at least $5 or something.
Or
nothing.
Something, yeah. But I mean, I think the whole movie only cost like $7,000 or $17,000, something like that.
Yeah, well, I know George Romero knew a butcher in Pittsburgh who helped him with what looked like the body parts and stuff like that. You know,
well, they had to improvise in those days, Stephen. They didn't have graphics and all that.
Right. So, well, again, that's why, you know, you go back to Ernest Borgnine actually being covered with rats, or Tippi Hedren actually being covered with birds. I mean, people don't have to go through that, you know, as much anymore with the CGI, the computer-generated images. So that's good.
Very good. Stephen, thanks for being on the program. Keep in touch with us, okay?
You got it. And the website, if people want to go to it, is hollywoodstories.com.
You got it. We're going to come back in a moment. A couple hours to go now. Those Friday night and the Saturday morning open lines. Plus, I think I'll open up a hotline tonight. Back in a moment.